This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. This is the last live episode of the show for 2020. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing? How do you feel about that?
You mean Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle. That's what you mean.
Why is that at first?
Oh, my God. My resolution for 2021 is to get past this little status fractional war. What is even happening? How did this begin? I don't think I made any kind of stand.
Oh, my. All right. Well, how are we doing? I think we're doing pretty well.
Yeah. I'm not too existentially tortured by the end of 2020. Yeah. I welcome it.
There you go. Good.
I feel that this is sort of where the temperature of the nation is like, on with it.
On with it. You got it.
Yeah.
I've been binge watching The Crown, which is fantastic, by the way, if people have not developed a crown addiction, but the season 4 just came out. So of course I had to watch like all 10 episodes in 2 days.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly good because of course this is the Princess Di season, right? Uh-huh. So it's like, oh man, talk about evolutionary psychology and you know, what she thinks she's getting into versus what she gets and Charles' defective, tortured personality and all of his distortion and everything else. Oh my God, I'm having a Doug moment. I completely forgot what I was going to talk about.
2000. Yeah.
Resolution. I totally
something
lost
about
it.
Binge watching a TV show. I lost you after that.
Yeah, no, maybe it'll come back to me. I've been hanging out with Doug too much. I just get into my departures and I forget the point of the story.
That's it. That's all right.
It was getting on with it. It was getting on with it. It was very Thatcher-esque because, of course, Princess Di overlaps with the era of Margaret Thatcher in Britain. So she's played by Gillian Anderson from The X-Files, and she's just this wonderful portrayal of this incredible, you know, the Iron Lady, this amazing battle axe of an incredible politician, and she's very much like, just get on with it, just suck it up,
get on with it. I might upset some people, but I had an email exchange with Alan Goldhammer today, and it was about COVID and mathematics and all this thing, and I finally said, you know what, let's just have 100 million people go ahead and get their vaccination if they want, and let's get on with it. Like, I've had enough of it. Anyway, all good.
Yeah.
2020's really just worn out everybody's patience on just about every front, I think.
Yeah, you got it.
I think the only winners are the meme creators for this year.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, no, it's been a banner year for the meme creators, the meme lords. The meme lords among us have triumphed.
All right, well, in the spirit of getting on with it, let's just go straight to the questions. Okay. Dear doctors, I miss Dr. Lyle's rants about the coronavirus. I think of them as rants as they seem passionate and detailed. So I thought I'd give a short rant of my own to try and provoke him. I'm in my mid-40s, and for almost my whole life, I've been a strong advocate of much stricter controls of driving, smoking, and drinking. I mean, individually, I'm not talking about doing all three at the same time. Literally, my only disclaimer is that I understand controls may lead to behavior to go underground, and so you'd have to allow for that. Otherwise, I'd say bring on the controls of these dangerous activities. Roughly 1.5 million people worldwide on the roads die every year. 7 million from smoking, 3 million from drinking. I believe the drinking one is arguably a big underestimate, and the others might be too, but let's be conservative. In a discussion, I always say to others, to save this many lives, and in the case of alcohol, remove vast swaths of antisocial behavior, I believe the acceptance of some downsides in our personal enjoyment of life are acceptable. Do you feel the same way? I personally don't own a car, don't smoke, don't drink, by the way. Others seem not to feel the same and often strongly say that the deaths are an acceptable cost to the ongoing enjoyment of such activities, relatively unsafe driving, smoking, drinking, etc. So the end of my rant is this. How fantastic is it that everyone's cost-benefit analysis has suddenly shifted so far to now accept infringements on personal behavior just to prevent COVID deaths? I say, welcome to the Saving Lives Party. I've been here enjoying it for many years, and I welcome you. Perhaps now we're ready to save a few more million lives with some relatively minor additional infringements of personal liberty. We could look at driving, smoking, drinking, etc. But then the replies ensue, oh wait, COVID is special? I've looked at the statistics, and yes, maybe it is, but it seems to me by far the least dangerous of the four, and yet we're doing much more about it. Weird. What say you?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question winds up being. Jen, do you see the question in there, or what do you sense?
Yeah.
Because I'm about to rant on libertarian principle, but before I do,
well, yes, I feel like this question is tailor-made for you, and so I'll just go for a walk while you just spend the next 47 minutes answering this. But I think the kernel of the question is why are we in such a fuss about COVID when there are these other risks that are much more dangerous, statistically speaking, and we're not making as much of a fuss about them. That's how I read that.
Oh, interesting. Sort of, interesting. I didn't.
I might be.
I didn't quite get there, but maybe that is what the person's saying. So, I can sort of see that. What I'm at first seeing at first blush is, hey, isn't this a good thing that we are tapping down on personal freedoms for, you know, the upside that comes from, quote, being safer?
I think that's some sarcasm.
Got it.
Yeah, that's okay. My interpretation. But
oh, God.
Who knows?
Don't get too intelligent with us, people, you know? All right.
Never on Shadow Masters.
Oh, man. I'm not sure I understand, but I will say this, that this, you know, Jen, I think, talked about this last week, and this is a... And we discussed it just a little bit, that this is a very interesting problem for, you know, a free society. I think that the founding fathers were closer to thinking clearly in principles. They didn't have as many million details to be thinking of because they couldn't envision everything. But I think the fundamental fundamental thoughts, I think, were possibly to some extent influenced by Adam Smith and his analysis of the invisible hand. And so the notion of you let things go and the optimization of freedom in markets winds up optimizing the output of the society's economy. And similarly, the same thing would happen in principle in a utilitarian fashion about just basic human life satisfaction, that as Jefferson would say, the government that governs best governs least, the least infringement on human freedom. And so the fact that smoking and drinking may cost some people, it doesn't cost them, quote, doesn't cost lives, it costs percentages of lives. There's a big difference. And so, you know, when they talk about, oh, COVID has cost 250,000 lives, it has not. It's cost 250,000 people a very, very small percentage of their life. It's a big difference. And so when it comes to the infringement of human freedom on the part of a government that is actually sort of optimally organized, you know, the governments in general, including the United States government, are not like the most brilliantly principled concept around optimize. They sort of are, but they're really They're not. It's pretty good. This is about it. This is as good as it's ever gotten. The kind of the reasonable clarity of thought about essentially setting humans free from other humans by minimizing government interference, but protecting individuals essentially against the state. And so the U.S. is about as principled as it gets with respect to that. And so the notion of an infringement on of the government on me for my own good for not drinking alcohol, I mean, that became the law of the land, and it was obviously a noteworthy utter fiasco, and the in prohibition, obviously. And so, but the government continues to do things like this and interfere in normal human exchanges, market activities, et cetera, making them illegal, et cetera, quote, for your own good. And I'm, you know, obviously deeply opposed to this, because my sense of life is one that the notion should be that we're going to optimize human life, if that's what we're asking about and that's what we're arguing about. We're going to optimize human life in principle by allowing human beings the maximum amount of freedom, i.e. the least possible infringement upon what it is that I want to do by you. And you don't get to say that, well, what I like to do is infringe upon you, so let me do it. It's like, no, that's not part of the equation. 1 second while I let my cat out. Hold on.
Speaking of freedom.
Yeah.
It's funny, yeah. I have my dogs are locked up in the bedroom and they're pawing at the door too. Yeah. So it's like, I'm just hoping that it doesn't get too dire.
Right. So yeah, I'm trying to focus here and, you know, I get that racket. So, I'm thinking now, I'm glad that Jen said that maybe that this was sarcastic, because I hope that it was. Otherwise, there's no end to the list of human infringements that some totalitarian-esque individual would start thinking that it's in my best interest to have everybody else having it infringed. Like, oh, I don't know, how about horseback riding? Horseback riding's dangerous. People get thrown from horses, they die, they get maimed, they have their lives wrecked. Well, we'll just eliminate horseback riding as a thing that people can do. What about playing hockey? Same thing. What about playing basketball? That's the same thing. What about having sex? Oh, well, you can get VD. Hell, you could get AIDS and die. So let's just make that illegal. You know, we can go, not to mention, I don't know, God, playing fencing, shooting guns, you know, going and playing golf, because that could hurt your back. Or you could be out in the weather and get hit by lightning and die. There is no end to it. So when you start realizing, okay, this is absurd. So where is there any legitimate place for government intervention? Well, you know, i.e., why shouldn't I be able to drive 180 miles an hour whenever I want? Answer, because now you're infringing on my safety. And so this is the where it crosses is where this happens. And so COVID is an interesting moment, you know, for governments to think about where does my searching for my own freedom wind up interfering on you, and where do we draw the line? And it gets muddy, okay? So from my standpoint, as a very principled libertarian, my answer is I don't want the government in it. I want somebody to be able to open their restaurant and have people go. And that restaurant can run it any way they want. And if you want to take your chances and wind up with COVID as a result of going to a crowded restaurant, that's your business, okay? And you might say, oh no, that's going to spread this terrible thing. And I would have to say, okay, let's look at it in the context of the overall CB of the society and what it is that we really think we all have to stand or to gain or lose collectively. At which point it makes sense to try to analyze just how lethal it is and what the costs are of this infection. At which point you drive yourself down to the analysis that I've been interested in, which is that you got 300,000 Americans have died of this infection or related conditions, but they've probably only lost about a year of life on average. 40% of the victims are in nursing homes or in adult care facilities, so we know what that means. We know that the average or the median age of death, I believe, is 78 for a COVID victim, and it's 78 for a person in the society. So as a result, we recognize the sum total human cost is very similar to that of having, you know, I don't know how many children are born a year in the United States. It's got to be about 1/80th of 300 and something million. So it's got to be maybe 5 million children a year. And let's suppose we lost, you know, 5,000 out of 5 million a year to some disease process. And if we did, we multiply that by 80 years of life, that would be 400,000 years of life. So if we were losing 5,000 children a year, that would be notable and disturbing, and there would be some action trying to figure out how to take care of it, but it would not be a national catastrophe. And we are, but that would be the same amount of life years lost as this. So to my way of thinking, this does not look like something where if you are infected, you are losing a massive amount of life. And therefore, if you happen to infect someone else who then goes and visits their grandmother in a nursing home and costs her a year of life, this is, to my way of thinking, well, why were you in contact with them? Well, because they were out and about. Okay? So if anyone wants to lock themselves down in a basement and, you know, get their orders in from Amazon and then disinfect everything with a spray and protect their life like it's this precious thing against this, you know, very low risk process if you are not an elderly person, that's fine with me. I have no problem with that. You're free to do that. But I do not think that you have any legitimate reasoning behind stopping me from taking my chances. I don't try to stop people from taking their chances from using heroin. That's their choice, okay? And could they, in theory, be high as a kite and then drive into me on the road? Sure, okay? That's a theoretical possibility. If they run into me on the road and we live and there's a bunch of damage and it turns out that they were under the influence, what happens? Well, they lose their license. That's reasonable. Okay, because what they did was irresponsible. But I don't consider it irresponsible for you to take your risks out in public in a pandemic where the cost to the average life of in the society is exceedingly small. Okay, if we multiply the sum total of years by the sum total of people that we have, the cost so far has been extraordinarily small. The societal response has been huge. Okay, I understand that running the math on these parameters and seeing it the way from the perspective that I see it is exceedingly difficult for people to do. There's a lot of problems in life where the human mind doesn't do a good job of analyzing the math because it's just a little too weird for it to do. There's a number of things like that.
It's so weird that we're predominantly relationship-oriented social creatures who don't think mathematically about the world. That is really weird. You're right.
It is. This is disgusting. So the point is, such is life. It is the way it is, and therefore, as a result of that, there are political realities that will fall out from that that are what they are, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure where, you know, where this person is winding up, and maybe they're winding me up to do this very thing, to try to look at it and share my perspective on this. For myself, being a relatively middle of the bell curve person when it comes to risk aversion, nothing fancy about me. You don't see me any with the fancy stripes that Jen has. Jen has war stories that are way fancier than mine. I'm pretty naturally conservative, and therefore, in general, I'm reasonably risk averse with respect to all kinds of things. But that when I look out at the landscape of businesses and people and what is it that they want to do, I just can't possibly see a justification given what we now know about the lethality of this virus. In other words, what the amount of life loss causes given an infection, I look at that and I say, no, people should be able to take their own chances. If it turned out that it was massively more dangerous, so that the average amount of life lost was 10 times what it is, then I would say, okay, you have a point. Okay, that would be the equivalent of a drunk driver. Drunk drivers killing far more people than they do. And therefore, if you get caught drunk driving, we throw away the key on you for 10 years. That would be, you know, a reasonable cost benefit. Some kind of cost benefit analysis would need to be done. And in fact, legal theory actually has that concept in it about how to run those cost benefit analyses for society's best interest. Those kinds of cost benefit analyses have been thrown out the window with respect to this. And so what we have instead is a fear-based little animal that can't do math, essentially influencing a political process that has led to a remarkable amount of oppression. I think it's temporary, so I'm not that worried about it. I think it's ridiculous, but I understand that humans are humans, and so that's going to happen. And so at the end of the day, I shrug my shoulders, and we wait for 100 million people ahead of me in line to get vaccinated, and then I'll just sit there and watch all the little penguins in the water, see if any of them get eaten, and by that time, I'll sit back and analyze whether or not I'll ever get that vaccine, which is probably no, and then we'll be back to normal, and we'll be the new normal will be look a lot like it was a year ago.
Dr. Lyle, thank you so much.
There you go.
Yeah.
Are you back from your walk yet?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we still recording?
Jen, so what is your 13 degrees off Dr. Lyle's take on this? Because I suspect things you have to say about this.
I mean, I don't have anything to add to the sort of political, theoretical, libertarian rant. So, I mean, to the extent that, you know, I identify largely as a political libertarian, like I'm completely in step with everything that he's talking about in that sense. I just don't quite think the question was really about that.
No.
I sort of interpret the question, and maybe I'm completely off
Dr.
base.
Lyle.
Yes, well, you know, he's been asked to rant, so
yeah.
He's dangling a treat in front of the animal. But I see it as a, you know, a version of the question that is like, you know, if why don't we have more of these kind of trade-offs between personal freedom and public safety with things that are more dangerous than COVID? Not necessarily. Mm. Advocating for them, just sort of asking like why the disconnect between these different costs in the different CBs that are being run. And of course my mind immediately with that question goes to the virtue signaling and the status acquisition that accompanies being in much more of a fuss about COVID than being in a fuss about, say, seatbelts or drunk driving or tobacco use or anything like that. There's just so much more to be gained in the village for certain personality types in the conditions that we're looking at with social media and everything else to grandstand over why we need more attention paid, more regulations, more fear-mongering in general, just any sort of energy that we can throw at the problem. There's a different cost-benefit analysis for this problem at this time in history, particularly for certain types of personalities, than there is for those other risks. That's sort of my take on it, but I might just be completely...
Yeah,
just on a LSD trip over here and reading a different question.
No, that makes perfect sense. It's interesting that you say that. I hadn't thought about seatbelts for a long time. And of course, I would say the notion that it's, you know, prohibited to not be wearing your seatbelt is ridiculous. However, nobody's ever going to get a ticket for it, for one thing. And by making it sort of the law of the land, that is actually an interesting piece of government education that is super useful. However, as a libertarian, I'm like, hey, let the insurance companies dictate this. You know, i.e., if you're caught and your seat, you know, you got a damage done to your head, but you didn't have your seatbelt on, too bad for you. You know, this says right here in our policy that that's not covered. So, yeah, as a libertarian, I'm just, you can see the point of a lot of people's angst about trying to get other people to change their behavior for their own benefit or even for the village benefit. But I sit, you know, at a position defending optimizing human freedom at a pretty hardcore. You know, I'm not as hardcore as some of the nuts, because one step over for me, Jen, is a nut.
one small step for a nut. giant leap for nut kind.
There you. All right, Nick.
We're gonna get another label. Last time you talked about gonads, Dr. Lyle, I got someone send me a box of nuts that says edible gonads. We're gonna get another one.
The only other thing that I would add in the libertarian discussion is that, you know, this is something I'm only very dimly aware of because I'm not a political theorist. As exciting as that would have been to wear extra tweed and elbow patches and to, you know, take up smoking a pipe early in my career and all of the wonderful things that go along with being a political theorist, but I am aware of debates in the literature about the applicability of libertarian principles and libertarian thinking to societies that are not fundamentally pretty homogenous, right? So it's kind of this that if you have a real diversity of values and of differential risk analyses and, and people basically paying different costs because they're coming from a very different cultural place, very different religious place, very different all this
genetic
diversity,
different genes.
Of course there's going to be, it's all driven by genes. So it's a different situation for the founders where there's great agreement on general values and sort of, okay, well, we're all just going to kind of let the market decide these principles. When you get into the current situation where we've got this incredible diversity of values and morals and differential perceptions of risk assessments that are deeply rooted in people, that essentially person X is subjectively paying a way higher cost for your freedom than somebody who shares those values with you. So it's an...
Right.
It's a debate within the literature. I don't think there are any easy answers to it, but it is a critique that sits out there.
Oh, which, that's so
interesting.
That's so fancy. I never even would have thought of that. That's why we have the little all-star team. It's beautiful, Jen. Thank you for even bringing that up. Yeah.
That's the sort of thing when I was talking about mask wearing.
Yes.
You know, what that's the reason I wear a mask is it's not to surrender to the most nervous denominator. It's not, I'm not being subjected to some kind of tyranny. It's actually the same principle that we talked about on a show a couple of weeks ago, where if you're living in a house with somebody who's messy, right? Like who rises to the occasion, who sort of adjusts their behavior.
Right.
I forget what you called this. You had a pithy, principled name for it. Yeah.
Right. I forgot what it was.
But I sort of, I apply that in the social, in the public sphere, right? So if there are people who are much more burdened by a particular policy, and it doesn't cost me a huge amount of my personal freedom, but that's, again, there's some sort of equation that would govern that.
You know,
what am I actually paying for in terms of my personal freedom? Well, wearing a mask for me, it's not that great. It's not a huge burden. You know, if I had to put on a full CDC Ebola suit every time I went out to the grocery store, that would be a higher cost to my personal liberty.
Right.
And if the risk of COVID were the existing risk of COVID, that would be too much for me, and I would feel burdened by that. So I think these are very dynamic. You know, they're going to change with all the circumstances, but it's just worth throwing out there.
Yeah. And, all good.
A small chink in the armor of libertarianism.
Yeah. Very small. Very small.
Like I remember reading when I was getting into libertarian thinking is a couple of studies. I think it was either Milton Friedman's book, Thomas Sowell's book, or another book of that nature. And they mentioned about seatbelts and also bicycle helmets, and that there were studies done that after the laws came out, that they found that the car crashes, people were dying at a greater frequency because they felt more protected. They suspected that people felt more protected, and so therefore they thought they could drive faster or whatnot. That was the argument there.
And then same thing. Show me the effect size.
Yeah. Of course, I'm not So I guess this is
sort of this in the op-ed of Reason Magazine.
Right. Oh my God! Exactly.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah. I think that these are rumors that we hear rather than fact. But the point is still there. And these are the trade-offs that I would like to see considered rather than just scared animals influencing political policy, which isn't even considering it. So anyway, that's where I'm at.
All right, our next question.
All right, on we go. Let's do something else. Don't we have some jealousy problem in a relationship to talk about or something?
Let's see. Maybe we should. I don't know. I can't see
just
that one.
Whatever we got, Nathan.
Okay, our next one is this is Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle. Because you guys own pets, this may be get interesting. Okay,
got it.
All right, dear doctors, Be Your Genes listeners are sophisticated enough to recognize that porn and video games represent supernormal stimuli that can be problematic because they ultimately get in the way of achieving meaningful goals. But if we're really honest with ourselves, wouldn't we also admit that dogs and cats are really just another form of this counterproductive supernormal stimuli? Meaning that they tickle the reward pathways meant to incentivize family formation, but could possibly inhibit us from doing the work to form meaningful bonds and offspring with potential mates.
Huh. Well, Jen, you can have fun with it, but I got plenty to say, but roll.
I mean, I suppose, yes, speaking as the 40-something crazy dog lady who never had children, I think it's, it's a whole separate conversation about whether video games and porn constitute supernormal stimuli to the point that they're getting in the way of achieving meaningful goals. I think we'd have to kind of interrogate that whole proposition, but maybe I can leave that for you to do, because I don't think that's going to be happening at the level that this questioner might be worried that that's happening. I think definitely having pets fulfills the parental circuit in a very significant way. This is such an individual game. I mean, I don't think you have this wholesale situation where the national fertility rate is declining because too many people have pets in their home and they're putting off having children because they've misapplied, like it's the pleasure trap of raising dogs instead of kids. I think that's very unlikely to be a meaningful problem in the demographics of the national welfare or anybody else's. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't satisfy that parental chip. It absolutely does. I mean, I do think probably if I didn't have dogs, there would be a lot of things that I would feel are missing in my life that I would be looking for more actively in a relationship. You know, the dogs are company. They are this kind of proxy for children. Dogs particularly are sort of perpetual toddlers. You know, cats are much more, you're living with peers. You're living with adults. Everybody's sort of like,
with your boss.
Knows the rules. Your boss. But dogs are very childlike. They're, mm-hmm. they're just, you know, constantly, even though my dogs are seniors now, they behave in a very childlike way. And so there is, to some degree with cats too, but it's absolutely, I feel very maternally toward them. And I can tell that those circuits have been to some degree hijacked, and any kind of earlier in life yearning for a child, which, you know, sort of bubbled up occasionally in my history. I haven't felt that in a very long time because I've had these dogs for over a decade now, or one or both of them. So I it definitely can supplement and perhaps even replace those impulses to some degree, but not at any level that we would need to be concerned about. And it's a personality specific thing. I am particularly susceptible to that so-called trap because of my immense love for dogs, which is genetic. You know, there were enough dogs in my ancestral history that you know made enough hunts more productive that I am very drawn to dogs in ways that other humans are not. So this has been a complicit willing arrangement that I have made with them, where I have sort of traded potential reproduction of children for this time with the dogs. I wasn't tricked, you know, I didn't wake up one day and be like, oh my God, I never thought about having children because I was so distracted. I thought I had children with these dogs. I think women who really want to have children, regardless of whether they have pets or not, that drive is not going to evaporate on them because of their maternal instinct toward their animals. I know plenty of women who have lots of animals and who are, you know, still yearning to have children, want more children. I think that is something that is individual to females specifically. Doug can speak more to the male brain on this, but I think if you've got the instinct, the sort of your biological clock is ticking for children, it ticks all day long, whether you've got puppies or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say this from a just the theoretical underpinnings of what the question is, and that is that supernormal stimuli are by no means necessarily negative. They can be extremely positive. And so, for example, well, I don't know, it's Christmas time. So the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, for goodness sakes, okay, that's a supernormal stimuli. That you would never have seen that in the Stone Age. And so you get to find out through, for example, music or, for example, the movies. You get to push the limits of what the human emotional system is capable of experiencing by getting an extraordinary stimulus in a cheesecake that would never happen. So you're never going to get a story told by a campfire in a single voice that is equivalent to Titanic, the movie. It's never going to happen. You're not going to have the music. You're not going to have the beautiful people playing it out, you know, very carefully acted, you know, 5 seconds by 5 seconds, caught on camera by an outstanding director with all, you're just never going to get anything even close to it. So you're not going to get that experience. You can't hit all the neural circuits in the organism so beautifully for 2 hours. You can't do it. You can have a really fine experience. You can have a great storyteller paint a picture with words and with their voice and with their gestures that could be magnificent. And it would be a great experience and maybe similarly moving, but you could never have a Titanic. You couldn't do it. And so there's nothing in the world wrong with that experience. It allows us to find the limits of, you know, what a human nervous system is capable of experiencing, how exquisitely. So that would go with a great many things, including pets. So pets have been essentially selectively bred by human beings to create extraordinary cost-benefit analyses emotionally for the owners. That's what they are. So undoubtedly, as Jen says, they started out more utilitarian and useful, and now they've morphed all their way to just being so damn cute and unbelievably exaggerated feedback systems of communication of love that it's like tremendously satisfying for people to experience that. That in no way is a problematic for the disruption of humans calculating what's in their best interest. We are essentially not trying to just settle for the payoffs of the genetic code for how we're designed to follow our feelings towards intense, ecologically valid sensory experiences that then result in what? The optimization of children, of the optimization of producing children. That's where that design goes. We are absolutely trying to beat that design. So we're trying to subvert the goals of that design to try to taper down. You know, we want just as exciting a romance and sex, but we don't want all the implications that come with it. Very few people do. Very few women want to have 16 children. And very few men would want to support them. They might want to have sex with a woman enough times to create 16 children, but they probably only want 2. So in the same way that we want to hear music, listen to stories, we want to, and pornography is an interesting example of, can you get a stimuli that when it's supernormal, is it disruptive to the person's, is it disrupting their ability to actually make a cost-benefit analysis on their time and energy utilization that winds up being a worse deal? And the answer to that is, of course, that's possible. So that's possible with food, drugs, pornography, gambling. There's a list of things out there, social media, okay? there's a list of feedback systems and stimuli that can essentially trap the organism into making what is probably lousy judgments. Is it always lousy? Is it always problematic? No, it's not. Okay. Nobody is going to ever make a convincing argument to me that the Snickers bars that I have eaten in this lifetime were a counterproductive pleasure trap that I'm going to pay some dire price somewhere in my old age where I'm going to regret that I ate them. Now, Alan might say so, but he's wrong. what we're after is we're actually, in some ways, we want to welcome supernormal stimuli into our lives where that stimuli represents an improvement over what the natural stimuli would be that we're actually designed by nature to be sensitive to. Okay, so I'm designed to feel admiration and like the sound of a really good voice, but you don't, why not have the best voice? And why not have it perfectly reproduced on a compact disc or in my iPod or whatever to have it great? Why not have it reproduced by a phenomenal speaker system when it was done in a studio? Why not? And the answer is there's no reason at all why not. So that's sort of the big, wide, theoretical answer to this question is, careful, supernormal stimuli are not in principle a problem at all. Specific supernormal stimuli represent a substantial threat to your ability to maintain an optimal calculus for how it is that you should be spending your time and energy if you're going to try to optimize your life experience. So we need to look out for those things while we take advantage of the other things and try to put together the best life path possible. That's what we're trying to do.
Even in the case of something like pornography, I can imagine.
Yeah. No, Sam, I want to hear what you have to say.
There are definitely cases, and I've talked to people who sort of are forfeiting potential real life romantic engagements because of a so-called addiction to pornography, or because of the sort of idealization of a certain type of mate that they can find in pornography that they can't find in the real world. So that is a real thing that exists with that kind of supernormal stimuli. But I don't think that exists with pets. I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
In having pets to sort of fill a space in your life that is unsatisfied by a real, an actual child or a real life example, and having it get in the way with going through the process of the romantic process and the sexual process and everything else that would lead you to following the mandates of your reproductive goals. I suppose it's possible in the world for a female to meet her dream guy and say, oh, you know, you're just 5% more trouble than my dog, and so I'm cool with just staying home with Fluffy. Okay, so yeah, good luck, vaya con Dios. Like I just don't think that that's often going to happen. Not to say that it couldn't, but it's not going to happen in the same way that it would with these other supernormal stimuli.
Yeah, I think as you would say, these other things, all of these supernormal stimuli would potentially carry a little bit of risk with it. Some of them would carry enormous risks, some of them carry moderate risks, and some of them carry probably almost none. And so that's how we should look at this. Yeah. All good.
Wonderful. Well, we started with analyzing risk, and we're ending with analyzing risk. I think
there you go.
It's a perfect way to end 2020, Dr. Lyle.
keep going. Put Dr. Hawk in front of Dr. Lyle one more time.
All right, so Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle.
It's only alphabetical. I don't get what big deal is.
Right, it's just, I understand.
Of course, not we'll a big deal it. At all. No, you're first, Dr. Lyle second, that's how it is. That's
it's not a, not a problem.
Yeah, the grass is green, the sky is blue, and Dr. Hawk is first.
That's it. Oh, man. All right, guys. Well, it's been a wonderful year with the two of you, and we'll rewind and reload as we begin 2021.
And I'm reminded, Dr. Hawk, by the way, and this is not patronizing. I got so much feedback from your statement on the New Year's resolutions about the process-oriented you know, process-oriented thinking surrounding goals that I re-listen to it every once in a while too. And so, you know, January 1st is right around the corner, and I guess that's when everyone's going to be allowed to start over again or start, you know, their resolutions anew. And so we're looking forward for 2021, yeah. Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle.
You will. Hold on a second. And also, Jen is going to have a little mini seminar for a few days in January that people should know about that exactly. That's true. It's going to, I'm not all sure what she's going to do, but this is a rare place where these principles are, I'm sure, going to be running through this, i.e. process over outcome, self-esteem over grabbing for something desperately. And so this is a good time of year for people that if you're wanting to sort of get your head very straight about how it is that we're going to pursue some goals. In this case, I think it's associated with health, weight, et cetera, but it could be anything. This might be something interesting for people to look into.
Yeah, Dr. Hawk, can you tell us a little bit more about this, please?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'm actually doing two things in January. So mm-hmm. one of them is called the Virtual Village, which is an outgrowth of the sort of group coaching that I've been doing in December. So people can sign up for that. And that's sort of anything goes in that conversation. So this month we've been talking about motivation and goal setting in advance of January for sure. But we talk about other things, just kind of what people are going through. It's sort of like a 12-step meeting meets group therapy meets a meditation session kind of experience. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in that, you can sign up on my website, jenhawk.com. And then also later in January, right around the time that everybody's New Year's resolutions start to fail them, I'm doing what I think Doug is talking about, which Doug has actually been recruited to be part of, which is just it's a four-day webinar series that is mostly around setting health goals and, you know, sort of dealing with the pleasure trap. But it can apply to any sort of goal setting process. It's just about what constitutes a smart goal? How do we align our intentions with our Stone Age circuitry? And how do we look out for the most common pitfalls? So there's a day where I will be talking with Doug about some things, and then also there's a day talking about just some of the specific dietary things involved with the pleasure trap with Dr. Michael Greger. So that will be later in January. I think it's the 26th through the 29th, and people can sign up for that on my website as well.
Cool.
And that's jenhawk, HOWK.com. So
HOWK.com. Yep.
I'm telling you, it should have been HAWK. Should have been
that's
Hawk.
What my dad, my father always did that. You know, he was this big radio guy, and he always, whenever he put his name in print, he just did it with an A. So,
yep. Oh, well, yeah, could be well, these cool logos, you know.
It's my contrarian great grandfather who didn't want a conventional spelling. I don't know where those genes came from, or you know, certainly wouldn't know anything about them. he had a super super typical name when he immigrated, and so he actually just made it up. It was a place name, but he didn't want it to be too conventional. Couldn't have that.
Oh, brother. Oh, man. All right, everybody. Well, great talking to y'all.
Then, so instead,
yeah. So well, awesome. Yeah.
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for this wonderful year. Lots of things we learned, especially with all the things, all the changes going on in the world with this coronavirus stuff, and you know, just interesting 2020. That's for sure. So let the 2020 jokes begin. Next year.
Cool.
Oh, God. Those are going to be awful, aren't they?
You got it. All right, Nathan.
All right. Have a good
night. Good job this year. You bet. We'll see y'all soon.
Okay.
All right. Have a good night, you guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.